from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, we'll begin this week with an update on the Malaysian Airlines crash in Ukraine, on developments in the conflict in the Gaza Strip, and on the crisis of migrant children at the U.S.-Mexico border and immigration reform efforts. We'll discuss these and other top stories. Join us for the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In this morning's opening Forum Hour, we've assembled a panel of leading journalists to discuss ongoing major crisis news stories and to update you on the ongoing escalation of aggression between Hamas and Israel, the investigation into the Malaysia jetliner shot down over eastern Ukraine, and ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine, as well as the tide of refugees pouring in at the U.S. border from Central America. Joining us for this in-depth discussion of these and other central news stories in this Monday News Roundup Hour, George Condon, White House correspondent with National Journal. He joins us from the nation's capital. Welcome to the program. Good morning, George Condon.
Good morning.
We'll also say good morning to Simon Montlake, who's with us this morning from Boston, Deputy International Editor, the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Simon Montlake.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you, and good morning to Margaret Olive, who is with us from D.C., White House Margaret Tolliver, excuse me, who is with us from D.C., White House correspondent with Bloomberg News. Welcome, Margaret.
Hi, Michael. Hi, everyone. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And I'm going to begin with you, Margaret. Let's first hear President Obama speaking this morning, calling for an immediate I want to hear President Obama talking about sending Secretary of State John Kerry to Israel to push for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza.
The work will not be easy. There are enormous passions involved in this and some very difficult strategic issues involved. Nevertheless, I've asked John to do everything he can to help facilitate a cessation of hostilities. We don't want to see any more civilians getting killed.
That, again, was President Obama speaking just this morning. And, Margaret Tolliver, it was the deadliest day yesterday for not only Palestinians, but the Israeli military, and the Egyptian proposal for a ceasefire simply went down. Hamas would not accept it. What are the prospects of Secretary Kerry and Ban Ki-moon bringing about some kind of a ceasefire?
I think the White House is counting right now on the hope that Israel and the Palestinians, that neither one really wants this to go very much further. I think that had been the conventional wisdom. Okay, it's a war. It'll go on for a few days, and it'll burn itself out. President Obama doesn't have a whole lot of leverage here, and he's doing what he can do. I think it's very interesting. What an extraordinary few days it's been to see these two areas where he really hoped to effect a change in his presidency, to bring about a peace deal in the Middle East and to have a reset with Russia. That both of them go so terribly wrong, literally on the same day. Late last week, and what he is trying to do now to reel both of these in. Sanctions only go so far. Rhetoric only goes so far. Attempts to internationally sort of mobilize the community. But really, in the end, it is the key players in both of these places, the Israelis and the Palestinians, and the Russians and the separatists, and to some extent the Ukrainians, who have to make these moves. The U.S. can't do anything.
Well, the U.S. may not have any leverage here, Simon Montlake, but what about the U.N. Security Council calling for an immediate Gaza ceasefire?
Well, I would actually disagree somewhat. I think the U.S. has tremendous leverage over Israel, given that Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid and has a very close relationship with the U.S. The question is more whether they want to use those levers. The question of Hamas is much harder because, of course, the U.S. won't talk to Hamas as a terrorist organization. And it has in the past relied on Egypt, in a sense, to be the broker or mediator there. But now we've had a change of government in Egypt since last year, and we've gone to a situation where Hamas is seen as equivalent to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is to say a terrorist organization which must be, you know, driven to the ground. So Egypt's not necessarily a great broker there, which is another reason why I think we're going to see a very difficult path. But there will be a ceasefire that comes out of it. The question really is, what is Israel hoping to achieve from this campaign? And at the end of the day, are we just going to rewind the clock back to where we were a couple of years ago with the same uncomfortable status quo, which doesn't solve the conflict in itself.
Well, what about, George Kahn, and the role of Mahmoud Abbas, of Abu Mazen in all this? I mean, we have essentially a unified government. Some say, in fact, the Israelis are concerned about not only demilitarizing Hamas, but also breaking that unity. Can he play a role here? He's meeting with Ban Ki-moon, and so for that matter is Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani.
Well, I think Simon probably is more knowledgeable on that, but my impression is that he has not been able to deliver on anything that the Americans and the Israelis had hoped he'd be able to deliver on in recent years. And you also get a reminder in this of unintended consequences and how little people can control what they think they could. In Ukraine, I don't think Putin has been able to control the separatists to the degree that that he would like, and Israel is discovering that what they thought would be a much faster operation, they've marveled at how much the fighters in Gaza have learned from past experience, and they're a much tougher foe than was expected.
And at least 5 people were killed and 70 injured by an Israeli strike on a hospital in Gaza, according to Palestinians earlier today. Earlier today, also, President Obama spoke this morning calling for immediate and full access to the crash site. We're talking about the Malaysia airline that went down in eastern Ukraine. Let's hear what the president had to say.
Unfortunately, the Russian-backed separatists who control the area continue to block the investigation. They've repeatedly prevented international investigators from gaining full access to the wreckage. As investigators approached, they fired their weapons into the air. These separatists are removing evidence from the crash site, all of which begs the question, what exactly are they trying to hide?
Let me take that question to you, if I may, George Condon. George Condon, again, is White House correspondent of the National Journal. What do we think the Russians are trying to hide here, or for that matter, the separatists, and are they one?
Well, it's very simple. They're trying to hide the truth and the facts. Almost certainly, plane was shot down by the separatists from their territory with Russian training and with Russian missiles. Now, they don't want that out. And also, they're not exactly a polished military operation. The sight of the gunman guarding the plane being drunk when the inspectors come in does not exactly give you great confidence.
There is certainly a lack of confidence that this is going to go forward, Simon Montlake. Dutch forensic scientists have examined bodies of passengers from the flight, and now we've got remains of at least 196 people loaded on refrigerated rail wagons in the town of Therese. It doesn't seem like necessarily the forensic work is going to go forward in the way that certainly those who have great interest here and are grieving nations like Holland and so forth would like to see it go forward. But I'm wondering at this point, what kind of leverage does the West have, particularly with sanctions?
Well, I think you're talking there about sanctions on Russia. I mean, the U.S. actually tightened its sanctions on Russia last week. And tomorrow we're going to see European leaders meeting. And I assume that they're going to make a pretty strong move on this as well. I mean, remember, the Putin strategy has been to see the U.S. as perhaps an implacable enemy on this and the Europeans as more malleable, so, simply because they are more reliant on Russian energy supplies. They have stronger trading relationships with Russia. There are domestic lobbies within Europe which would like to see more open policies to Russia. There are many Russians spending their money freely in Europe. So I think Putin's policy has really been to sort of try and divide those two. And so if we see the EU becoming tougher and moving more towards the U.S. position of harsher sanctions, of naming companies, individuals that really start to sting Putin's inner circle and his economic might, then I do think we're going to be in a changed situation. But, I mean, the swing within Europe really comes down often to Germany as the biggest economic power. And, you know, Chancellor Angela Merkel has not been always clear on this. I mean, she sympathizes with Putin somewhat. They're both children of the Soviet era, in a way. And I think we're going to have to see where our hand lies. I do think that European moves on sanctions are going to be crucial, because we already know that the U.S. is prepared to go far, but the Europeans is somewhat divided on this.
What do you think, Margaritella? Are we going to get the EU behind stiffer sanctions?
Well, you know, Putin and the separatists know that one of the remaining levers that they actually have is the forensic access to the bodies to do these investigations. And I think there's some possibility that we will see still a more diplomatic approach than one that it's everyone's gut instinct to use, because if you sort of light everything on fire and push for more sanctions, the access to the evidence goes out the window. So on the other hand, I think you see that there is a real recognition sort of the limits, either of sanctions or of the sanctions that people are willing to do. When you see President Obama, Prime Minister Cameron, several world leaders already today and throughout the day, we'll see more of this, talking about sort of the moral imperatives, the least you can do as a decent person, et cetera, sort of telling Putin, look, if you want to be a world leader, there's some sort of baseline rules you have to play by. That is a recognition that sanctions, or at least the sort of sanctions that the Dutch and everybody else, Germans are willing, the French are willing to go forward with at this point, may not be enough to sort of compel Putin to change his mind. And the world, everyone is waiting to see how Putin responds now.
Of course, this puts him in a more defensive situation, doesn't it?
Which sometimes makes him act more aggressively. It's not like, you know... it's not like he's easily cowed. I mean, that's been sort of the whole point of the question mark about how to proceed with Vladimir Putin, is that he can be very defiant, very insulated by construct from a full sort of range of information that's coming in, and that it's not entirely clear that putting more pressure on him will yield what the West wants.
George Condon, we're going to talk mainly about three major stories here, and I want to get your take on what's going on at the border. You wrote an article about President Obama not going to the border, and I take it from that, or I infer from that to some extent, that perhaps he missed an opportunity?
Well, I think he was in a no-win situation on that one. Had he gone to the border, had he gone to be photographed with these, heart-tugging, adorable kids in the tough situation, and his message to them is, well, you're cute, but I'm deporting you all. That's not exactly a great message to send out, and it's certainly not one that the left would have wanted to see. What he botched was not so much that he didn't go to the border, it's that he looked like he was tugged and pulled and yanked into even talking about it while he was in Texas, that he didn't want to be bothered while he was trying to raise money for the Democratic Party. He should have been more proactive. He should have... planned something in Texas before all the criticism, but I'm not overall critical of the fact that he didn't go down there to deliver his deportation message surrounded by kids.
But he's kind of between a rock and a hard place, Margaret Tolliver. He said, actually promised to the Hispanic caucus that he would honor migrant rights to due process while he's stepping up number of deportations.
That's right. Really, President Obama's predicament has been months in the making, which was that even as these numbers were accumulating over the course of the year about children, unaccompanied minors, that what the White House was focusing on was sort of almost the opposite, which was, if we can't get the Republicans in Congress to do an immigration bill, what can I do unilaterally to ask, my Department of Homeland Secretary, my DHS secretary, to figure out administratively what we can do to sort of liberalize or ease some of the immigration policies. We can't do both at the same time. One really almost completely contradicts the other. And so they're in this conundrum where their initial timetable was, let's see what we can do to ease away in some cases for undocumented workers by the end of the summer. And now it's like, oh, okay, we got to play ball with the Republicans on the border problem. Let's figure out how to get some more money for shutting down the border. I mean, it's a very difficult conundrum for him. And that and the dumping of Eric Cantor and the rise of a new majority leader has made it really, really difficult for the president to have sort of any partners in Congress to get both, let's say there was a way to do both, right? To get both done in one bill. Not going to happen this year.
Well, there's a $3.7 billion spending request from the president, and the GOP wants to speed up the return to Central America of these kids who are flowing in. But you got 1 week till the congressional recess. I mean, what can really be done?
Anyway. And you've also got the GOP saying, we'll take the half that's for border security, and we're not giving you the half that's for dealing with the housing and care of these children who are already here. Yeah, they're saying you can forget about that half.
And yet more deportations are being reported, George Condon.
Wait a minute. Let me get this straight. You were just expecting action out of Congress? I'm sorry. I live in Washington. I'm not used to those two words being put together. No, I mean, you know, you've had 57,000 unaccompanied kids come in just since October. What the president is doing is moving diplomatically. He's meeting at the end of this week with the presidents of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, and that's where these kids are coming from. And one of the things they're trying to do is get them to turn off the flow.
And if I could go back to Ukraine with you, Simon Montleg, just for a moment. We have news now from an AP report that a train with bodies from Malaysia plane crash has left the station, destination unknown. And this is a little bit of a riddle. Any thoughts?
No, I mean, that's what we're all trying to figure out. I mean, you know, the train is being loaded in the territory controlled by the rebels. Now the train line goes into what is now in government hands. And in fact, we've seen fighting overnight and early this morning around Donetsk. So, I mean, the Ukrainian military is trying to advance there. But, I mean, you know, it's hard to see why you would send a train into the other side's camp. I do think that the separatists have every intention and every motivation right now for trying to I don't know if cover up's the right word, but basically hold on to whatever they have as bargaining chips. I mean, I think it doesn't take much just to look at a few months to see these guys are really finished. And I would imagine that their backers, their sponsors, whoever they are, we don't necessarily know if they go to the top in Russia, but there appear people within the security establishment who see an interest in stoking things there. I think those people will be cutting ties and covering their tracks as well. So you have to put yourself in those guys' situation. I mean, they could be very well hung out to dry if, you know, a one level to be sort of to fall victim to a Ukrainian offensive, which they can no longer defend themselves against, on the other to be the criminal suspects in a, you know, in the downing of an international plane. So their situation doesn't look too good right now.
Well, there's also reports of heavy street fighting still going on in the main rebel-head city of Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. And so we've got that to contend with as well at this point.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, the Ukrainians actually went on a counteroffensive just a couple of weeks ago. And in fact, that's sort of the build-up to where we are now. What happened last week is that the Ukrainians, having seized the momentum, found that they were running into missiles, ground missiles launched their jets. And in fact, last week, two Ukrainian Air Force jets were shot down, one a fighter, the other one a transport plane, which the separatist rebels immediately claimed as a great victory for themselves. Which, of course, leads us to believe that, well, if they shot the first two down, isn't it likely they shot the next one down? And indeed, they did, and immediately claim it and then try to cover their tracks on social media. So, I mean, that's where we are today. This all comes out of the Ukrainian counteroffensive. I mean, a month or so ago, it was all about, you know, peace talks, and maybe the new president of Ukraine might be able to talk his way out of this. But that seems to have been abandoned altogether. So we're into possibly a fight for the death there.
We're talking this hour with three leading journalists who've joined us to discuss some of the recent crises that have gotten a great deal of news coverage. This is a news roundup about the Malaysia Airline ongoing attempt to do an investigation of that, about the invasion and ground war in Gaza, and certainly also about the crisis at the border. And if you have some thoughts you'd like to add to this conversation, or if you have question or comment, we would welcome your calls and we would welcome your input. Our toll-free number is available to you, our listeners, and you can call us now. It's 866-733-6786. Welcome your thoughts and any questions or comments you might have. Again, join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. And you can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but we'd certainly like to hear from you. And I'd like to hear, Margaret Talla, from you just for a moment, if we can, about another big news story concentrating on these three, but that is the LGBT non-discrimination executive order. I mean, this prohibits essentially workplace discrimination, and it came down today. Some thoughts?
Yes. Well, I mean, President Obama, ever since his evolution on the issue, but even before then, you know, has been an advocate for the gay and lesbian community. This really takes it a step further in terms of saying that federal contractors can't be participating in discrimination. And this applies to something like 25,000 companies. So it could be very broad-based. What's really interesting about this is the timing, because coming after the Supreme Court ruling on the contraception, a lot of this is about whether religious entities or contractors who have some religious affiliation can exempt themselves from this, can carve themselves out. And the early indications are that no, that's not going to be possible, at least not the way the president has constructed this. So it is both an effort to get things right with the gay and lesbian community and to sort of mitigate the the reach of that contraception ruling by the Supreme Court so before it spills into other areas.
And before we bring in our listeners here and find out what is on their minds with questions and comments, George Condon, you've already commented rather eloquently about the inaction in Washington. What about the overhaul of the Department of Veterans Affairs? I mean, this is pretty much weighed down now over cost and doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
Well, it's not something that the overhaul of that department is not something you're going to see in the headlines every day. I mean, the president has moved to shake up the leadership, brought in somebody with business experience, and one of the things that the leadership has to deal with that has caused some of this problem is the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have just brought a number of patients and challenges to the VA that aren't going to be solved overnight, and you're going to have backlogs. And this is not something that's going to be solved. The president boasts about using his phone and his pen. Well, it's going to take a lot more than a phone and a pen to solve the problems at the VA.
And again, George Condon is White House correspondent with National Journal. We're also talking with Simon Montlake, Deputy International Editor of the Christian Science Monitor, and Margaret Tolliver, who is White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Let me go to your calls, and let's not tarry here and bring in Jack as our first caller. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me. Can you hear me okay?
Hear you fine.
Yeah. Hi. You know, I wanted to comment on the downing of the Malaysian airliner and how it's really not being reported accurately. And one of your guests just kind of fell into line as an example of this. I mean, you have, you know, people, especially in the Western media, just jumping to conclusions about how the Russians shot this down without really looking at any evidence, and you've got these sensationalistic headlines saying things like "Putin killed my baby," and you know we really haven't given time to really sort this out. And there's been a number of issues. The Ukrainians haven't released any air traffic control data. The plane was diverted last minute by whom we don't know. So it really isn't as cut and dry as the media is making it out to be, and it kind of harkens back to the whole chemical weapons issue in Syria last year, and you had these same sensationalistic accusations without any proof. So I'd like to get your guests' opinions
on
that.
All right, as we come up on the break here, Simon, I'd like to hear what you have to say. I just wonder why that plane was flying over a war zone to begin with, but is it fairly conclusive and incontrovertible in your mind that Russia was not only supplying but also perhaps even directing or encouraging?
No, I wouldn't say the latter. I'd say we know pretty sure that a missile was fired from a particular area that brought down a plane. That missile is a Soviet-era weaponry which is available to both the Ukrainian and the Russian militaries, and others for that matter. So you couldn't specifically say from that one fact that you have a fix, as it were. And in terms of whether the missile came from Russia, the rebels themselves claim to have captured a Ukrainian anti-aircraft missile system earlier this month. So, in fact, you know, it may well have been that missile that was fired. The U.S. government claims that it was moved across the border. But again, this has not been confirmed. But I would not say that we are speculating to say that it come from that particular area.
Well, we will continue hearing from more of you and from our guests, George Condon, Simon Montlake, Margaret Tolliver. When we return, stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is a Monday morning news roundup of major stories with three leading journalists who are with us by phone. We're talking about Malaysia Airline, ongoing investigation, and attempt to put that whole story together. The Gaza invasion, it just turned into a ground war with Israeli troops there, and rockets are being fired back, of course, from Gaza, continuing into Israel. And, of course, the border crisis, but also more stories, and we do want to hear from you. So if you'd like to contribute your own thoughts or opinions, we welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, Our website is kqed.org/forum, and you simply have to click on this segment if you'd like to join us, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle, again, is at kqedforum. With us, Margaret Tollib from Washington, D.C., White House correspondent with Bloomberg, Simon Montlake, who is in Boston, who is deputy international editor with the Christian Science Monitor, and George Condon, who is White House correspondent with National Journal, also with us from the nation's capital, and with us by phone. George, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. My comment is with regards to the violence in Gaza, and I think one of your guests alluded to this earlier. We could eliminate the violence very quickly over there by immediately withholding all economic and military aid to Israel unless they immediately pull out of Gaza and recognize a separate Palestinian state. I'm not anti-Semitic, but many of your listeners need to know many of us in the United States are appalled and disgusted by Israelis' treatment of the Palestinians. So we have the leverage. We lack the political will to use it because there's such a strong pro-Jewish, pro-Israeli lobby in the country, and that is a fact that needs to be recognized.
All right. What about that fact as the caller presents it, Margaret Tollib?
Well, yeah, when we were speaking in the beginning of the conversation and I said there's not very much President Obama can do, I meant there's not very much President Obama is going to do. So, there's no indication from his comment or from any of the comments of anything that would constitute the beginning of a plurality in Congress that the U.S. Political structure is poised to do anything that dramatic.
Especially not with an election coming up.
Well, and they've also said from the outset Israel has the right to defend itself. I think part of the issue beyond political will, beyond these questions, is that when you're dealing with this joint governing structure now with Hamas in the Palestinian territory, the U.S. Really is in a position where it doesn't feel like it's like it has a different sort of leverage over the Palestinians, and so they're not going to punish it. It's just not going to happen. I mean, they are. His rhetoric today in the president's public remarks with Netanyahu saying enough civilians have died. You know, you have a right to defend yourself, but this is getting out of hand. It's my sense that that is about as far as the U.S. is willing to push it, at least publicly. At this point.
Well, let me read a comment from a listener on our website. Mike writes, by continuing Israel's settlement building program, Netanyahu made it clear to Obama early in Netanyahu's premiership that he was going to run Israel as he saw fit and that Obama just needed to get out of the way. Israel has enough friends in Congress to keep the billions of foreign aid flowing every year. Again, an opinion from a listener on that same subject. And we just got this in, Simon Montlake, breaking news from the Associated Press. Malaysia's prime minister has reached a deal with the rebel leader to allow safe access to the crash site.
Well, that would be something. I mean, the Malaysians have been quite cautious on this, if you look at it. I mean, they haven't joined in the echo of many Western leaders accusing Russia of indirect, if not direct, involvement in the shooting down. I think the Malaysians are much more cautious on this, and of course they've had their own cross to bear in terms of planes going missing. So that might be interesting development, that Malaysia is seen as perhaps less hostile or less part of the whatever U.S. bloc, that perhaps separatists would hand them over. I mean, I would like to see that actually happening. I mean, we still don't know what they're doing with the bodies, where the bodies will be transported to, and I would say the black box obviously holds important information about the flight, but from what I can gather, I'm no expert on this, in terms of the forensic investigation of a plane shooting down, whether it's Pan Am 103 or whatever, a lot of the time the clues come from actual debris and material which will reveal more, say, than just the cockpit recorders. So there's a whole lot of stuff that investigators would need to build a criminal case or whatever case you want to build against the perpetrators of this attack.
Well, can we assume that a lot was simply cleaned up from the crash site, that the separatists made sure? Again, I don't necessarily want to make them culpable without an investigation that's going to be full, innocent until proven guilty, but we can assume that a great deal has been taken away, can't we?
I think we can. You know, whether they knew what they were taking away and why, I mean, the first thing they presumably would look for, if they are indeed the people that fired the missile, would be to find the parts from that missile, and that would be the first thing you would think of removing. But again, I mean, you know, from looking at the impact onto the materials in the plane, I mean, you know, the investigators could eventually piece together, you know, enough convincing proof of what brought the plane down. But I imagine it was a very chaotic scene, and these separatists didn't quite know what they were doing. I mean, it may even be that there were different groups in control of different areas. I mean, it's not one united military command, as I think George alluded to. So we don't know who was, you know, who was giving the orders at this stage. But there would have been a general feeling of, you know, we've got to cover our tracks, or at least this could come out looking very bad for us.
Well, in terms of culpability, George, let me go to you on this. There's a Facebook comment from one of our listeners named Douglas who says, please discuss the tweet from Separatist Commander claiming credit for downing of the military plane. The tweet was then removed after the plane was identified as Malaysian flight. This is damning, in my opinion.
Well, it certainly is damning. Now, they claim that that was a product of Ukrainian intelligence, which seems unlikely, but this all should remind us that we do have to be cautious in what we say. I sort of winced at some of the things that were said on cable in the immediate hours after the plane went down. You remind yourself.
Isn't there a tenth, one of the first commandments for good journalism? Wait until you sort things through, because we've heard many stories that have gone up. Yeah.
And remember how we've been wrong in the past, because when Lockerbie, when Pan Am jet went down, U.S. intelligence initially believed that that was the result of Syria. It turned out it wasn't. It was Libya.
Yeah.
So I'm always cautious. I do think the initial evidence is pretty strong that from what we've heard that the missile was fired from the Donetsk area, and it certainly points to the separatists doing it. But it is our job to be cautious, and as Simon was before.
And we'll bring in more callers. This is a caller from South Carolina. Paul joining us. Good morning.
Good morning. Two quick points. When it comes to the border, I'm curious why this administration has not encouraged an Arab Spring in South America. My point there is, if they have a problem with their government, they should go to their government and discuss it with their government. Protest like in Syria and Egypt. The other point I would make, and this is the stronger point. The president has a laissez-faire foreign policy, which if that's what he wants, he's the president. My only problem with a laissez-faire foreign policy is that you risk the outcome. With laissez-faire, you hope it works out. Trust but verify. So I'd like your response, and I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thank you for that call. It's actually probably not so much the governments we're talking about, Margaret Tolliver, in Central America as much as gangs and criminal activity and the opportunity to come to America.
Right. There's so much that has nothing to do with what President Obama has signaled and what the administration's policies have done that have helped shape the climate that makes the sort of the calculus of whether to send your child with a coyote and see if they can make it across the border, you know, worth doing. I mean, it's not like the economic promise of the United States for a five-year-old is that great. It's got to be really bad for any human parent to say, yeah, this is the right thing for us to do with our child. And also, I think it's worth saying, we've been talking about how Obama wanted to try to liberalize some stuff around the edges, but also don't forget the reason he got into hot water with so many of the activists in the Democratic Party and the immigration community was because the administration was doing these sort of record-level deportations. So a lot of people are coming across, and a lot of people were getting deported. And it becomes a chicken or an egg question. I don't know that his policy is laissez-faire so much as that it is really it's kind of bipolar. I mean, like, on the one hand, he's saying, we're not going to deport 12 million people. What do we got to do here? And, you know, children and sort of college students and youth has been this one area that they, you know, with the DREAM Act and military service and stuff that they always wanted to sort of focus on. But then this exodus, this 50,000-plus figure, it just became so huge and so overwhelming to the system that it's forced him to revert to more of a deportation-based response when he was trying to do the opposite thing.
Well, you've got people like Ted Cruz who are essentially saying, you know, that these youth permits to work, this two-year policy is the reason behind this huge exodus.
Not with a five-year-old, it's not, or a six-year-old. But yeah, I mean, there are mixed signals that the administration is sending. There are also, as you pointed out, criminal and economic sort of predicates that are making the choice of making a voyage like this seem more worthwhile.
And one cannot underestimate the role here, George Condon, also of the coyotes and of those who are profiting.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And these are not highly sophisticated people. They know they're in danger at their home. They see, as generations have seen, America as a beacon of hope and safety for their kids, and they believe these coyotes.
But there's also 87% right now, I believe the latest figure I saw, of these cases that have simply been unresolved. I mean, they're talking about, we did a couple of programs on this, we talk about somehow adjudicating these cases case by case, and I don't think we have the resources to do that, and I think too many of these kids are disappearing, whether they're disappearing with family members or friends or simply disappearing.
Well, the system certainly wasn't built to handle these kinds of numbers. It shouldn't be a surprise that the system is overwhelmed right now.
In fact, I'm reading an email from a listener who says, is this a refugee crisis or immigration policy issue? Mm-hmm. Is it not true that the 57,000 and counting are fleeing war-torn countries and fleeing for their lives? Also, how marked is this surge? Drug-related violence has been going on for many years in Central American countries and Mexico. If the surge is indeed marked, what accounts for the sudden increase? That's a big question on many people's minds, and maybe in some ways almost as enigmatic as whether we're talking about the United States being a compassionate place. Give me your tired, your poor, and those who are seeking asylum or seeking refuge, or whether the United States can really sustain these huge numbers. Another listener writes on Israel, to Hamas, Israel is not a 1967 problem. It's a 1948 problem. The mere existence of the state of Israel is an anathema to Hamas. Simon Montlake.
Well, that's true. I mean, Hamas, let's not forget, emerged as sort of an Islamist alternative to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was Yasser Arafat, the original sort of resistance movement. And in fact, somewhere on the line, Israel actually quite encouraged it, was quite keen to see that opposition because it weakened the Arafat and his secular group. But of course, you know, they became a bit of a monster. I mean, their charter does commit them to destroying the Jewish state. You know, they're not in any position to do that right now. So it's somewhat aspirational. I mean, they've fired, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of rockets into Israel over the last couple of weeks and have caused, you know, minimal casualties. I mean, I'm not saying that that's not a terrible thing to have happen to you, but I mean, their aspiration to sort of, you know, liberate the Palestinian people and seize back all the land from 1948 is never going to happen. What they do rule is a desperately poor, underdeveloped part of the country, which just happens to be next door to Israel, so can't be ignored. So I think Hamas at this stage, their ambitions is essentially to go back to ruling their fiefdom and to be in control and to have access to the borders. So that's where they are. Israel would say that they are, you know, a sort of existential threat to them. I don't think they really believe that. I think the existential threat in the Middle East would not come from, you know, Hamas in their little coastal strip down the road. It would come from, you know, an Iranian nuclear bomb or something far more apocalyptic than that.
And here is another caller. Jack, you're on.
Yeah. What was not covered in the U.S. press and was covered by the London Guardian was Israel's use of flechette shells in Gaza. A number of human rights organizations have reported this. Israel is using flechette shells, which spray out thousands of tiny and potentially lethal metal dots in its military operation in Gaza. So really, the position that Israel has taken, that it has every right to defend itself, doesn't really hold water.
Got a comment, Simon Montlake, from you on that?
Yes, our reporter in Gaza hasn't seen these projectiles, but yeah, I've seen photos of them, and the Israeli army doesn't deny that it has them in its military arsenal and that it will use them. It says that sometimes this is a necessary military tactic, but clearly, I mean, it's an indiscriminate usage in an urban area, as indeed is you know, launching artillery shells or drone attacks or even tank fire. I mean, this is a very densely populated, packed, mostly urban area. So there's no way. I mean, Israel would never pretend that it could have done this operation without causing civilian casualties. I mean, the question you have to ask is, you know, what stage does that death toll and the number of injured start to, you know, outweigh the military objectives. We may well be at that point. It's just very hard to say. And I think Israel public opinion so far doesn't seem to be leaning away from it. I mean, it's still seen as a justified an action, and there is this kind of feeling that we want to get the job done this time.
Well, once again, we have just mutually exclusive narratives. I mean, the Israelis are saying that civilians are being used as shields, and Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, I suppose, those at least sympathetic there to Hamas, are saying, you know, they're killing civilians. I mean, it's just completely different reportage.
True. I mean, they're both true in the sense that, you know, Hamas and its leaders and members of it, of its organization, whether it's the military wing or the police or whatever it is, I mean, they are living amongst the people in the sense that their offices, their homes are right there. And these have been targeted. People have been killed in their homes. And the Israeli military will say that some of these homes are actually command and control centers, that they have a military objective, that the Hamas uses them to run their military operations, that they could be building bombs there or rockets, or they could be even launch pads. So from Israel's point of view, they would say that, you know, you can't say that these are houses when they're also military bases. From the point of view of the people living there, they are indeed their houses. And if you live next door, you're caught up in it.
Let me bring another caller in. Stephen, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yes, thank you. I'm just calling regarding an earlier caller in the response that Israel should just give the Palestinians a state and pull out. I would counter and say the first thing that needs to happen is the Palestinians, or specifically Hamas, needs to accept Israel as a state and admit that they will not attack Israel anymore, and I think the whole cycle will come to an end. And I would, you know, like to hear your guest respond to that side of it, that it's coming from a peaceful side rather than a constant drive the Jews into the seaside.
Simon, can we go to you on this? Simon Whiteley?
Sure. I mean, that is part of what Hamas says, and Israel is quite right to insist that they take that off the table before you, you know, get down to any sort of negotiations. But, I mean, at this stage, you know, Israel does have a counterpart, which is, you know, Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority, who, you know, doesn't have that demand on the table and is, you know, at least we, from what he says, he believes in nonviolence, he believes in negotiation. So it does have a counterpart who it can go to, who represents the bulk of the Palestinian people in that area, and can say, well, you know, we could sit down and we can talk rationally and try to come up with a deal. And, you know, Secretary Kerry tried to make that happen and it fell apart. So I agree that Hamas's demands are, from Israel's point of view, completely unacceptable, but that's not to say that all Palestinians would hew to that same, you know, uncompromising and essentially violent and, you know, unreasonable view.
Actually, Simon, a friend of mine who follows the Middle East very carefully said yesterday that Abbas has become so unpopular in the West Bank that he would probably lose in an election and Hamas would win. And in Gaza, Hamas has become unpopular with this war going on, that they would probably lose and Abbas might win.
It's very true. I mean, Hamas, remember, you know, took over Gaza and drove out Mahmoud Abbas and his people because, you know, they were seen as a better alternative. I think by now that's probably definitely that view is worn off. But yes, Abbas has actually been very weakened by this crisis, both by the kidnapping crisis, which is how we started with this, the three kidnapped teens from Israel who were later found murdered. I mean, that weakened Abbas very much so, because Israel's response was quite strong and he looked like, he, you know, he wasn't standing up for the people. And even now, he seems to have been sidelined by things. So it's a bitter blow for him. But I mean, it may also be a bitter blow for Netanyahu. We just don't know how these things turn out. I think both sides have the hawks on both sides are perhaps in ascendancy now, but you know, hopefully that won't be the case going forward.
Well, let me go back just for the time being to Ukraine, because we're getting a lot of emails and responses on that as well. And Margaret Tolliver, if I can go to you, one of our listeners, Bradley, writes, it seems that one of the critical elements to the crisis in Ukraine and the lack of peace progress is the European dependence on Russian gas. If the world is serious about ending that conflict, then why don't we quickly come up with alternative gas supplies for Europe? Yes, it will raise global gas prices, but that would give Europe breathing room and will to apply real meaningful pressure to Russia.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting comment, because the practical question becomes, how quick is quickly? The U.S. has really moved rhetorically to make this point and to encourage Europe more aggressively behind the scenes than publicly, but also publicly. Hey, guys, you know, if energy is the problem, then let's deal with this in different ways. But there doesn't seem to be sort of an instant, like, just add water response to this. And it's been a problem for the Ukraine as well as for Western European countries. I do think that the death toll in the Netherlands, you know, for one country alone, such a small country, has added a new imperative to all of this. But these are, even if there was a quick response, it would still be a medium-term response, you know, not a short-term response.
And but you could argue that one of the reasons the Netherlands was so temperate in its response is it's very dependent upon Russian gas.
I 100% agree. So, but they have a different imperative now than, you know, than France or than Germany does. I think you are seeing Europe recognize that they may need to sort of rally and approach this in a different way, but how quick that's going to be and how quick solutions to the energy problem and sort of the economic problem that surrounds that can be, you know, I think probably not quickly enough to, you know, turn on a dime tomorrow. And it hasn't been that long since, forget about the U.S., since Europe emerged from real financial crisis, and there is a real sensitivity inside Europe not to. I think they're all kind of scratching their heads at how could we be spending this much time and focus worried about Russia? Russia wasn't supposed to be our problem, you know. It's been sort of slow to recognize that this was not just something that was going to go away. And I think there does have to be a serious conversation now about energy resources and dependence on Russia, but I'm not sure that it's going to happen quickly enough to satisfy sort of the immediate response.
And again, Margaret Tolov is White House correspondent with Bloomberg. She's with us from D.C. And let me just pursue a little bit on Ukraine with you, George Condon. I'm looking at an email from a listener named Matt who said, can you comment on the Ukrainian shootdown of the Russian civilian jetliner in 2001, killing all 78 aboard? Also, there are reports that Ukrainian fighters were in the area of the Malaysian flight. Does it not seem fair that the Ukrainian government at least answer whether they had fighters in the area or whether they had any buck launchers in the region?
Well, the easy answer is it's fair for everybody to answer the questions. And it's a reminder again of why we do not rush to judgment on that. But there's no indication that this was a plane shot down by fighter jets. They didn't show up on anybody's radar. There was no indication of that at all. Every indication is that it was shot down by a missile and not a missile from Ukrainian territory. So I think those questions are a little bit off the issue.
Do we know, George, whether it was a SA-11 missile or a Buck M1 missile at this point?
If they do, they have not told us, and I don't think you would know that until you have a chance to sift through the evidence.
Bring another caller, Roberto. That's you. Thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
I'm calling because there was a comment earlier that maybe the U.S. needs to foment an Arab Spring in Central America. And I think that misses the point of the root of this fleeing of children from these failed states is the fact that the U.S. has intervened for decades in Central America. All of the countries in which the U.S. has intervened the most, and most recently with the Obama administration recognizing the coup government in Honduras, from which most of the children are now fleeing, demonstrates that the U.S. has not been a good supporter of democracy in Central America, and in fact has propped up these governments that have eventually failed their folks, and is very much the root cause of these children fleeing nations, where we've not only supported failed states, but also have deported many of the folks from the U.S., after them getting training and involvement on the streets here and sending them back to these failed governments where they're unable to deal with all these deportees who've been running around the streets of L.A. So it's not that we need more U.S. intervention in order to prevent children from fleeing. What we need the U.S. to do is to actually take more of a hands-off approach, I think, or to be supporting democracy rather than supporting the overthrow of democratically elected governments in Central America.
All right, Roberto, I thank you for that call. And apropos of that call from Roberto, for another angle on the border and immigration crisis. Richard in San Francisco writes, why should special attention be given to children attempting to flee violence in Central American countries as opposed to the 1,000 or 10,000 times as many children in other more dangerous parts of the world, primarily Africa and the Middle East? And how can these children be granted asylum in any case if the law requires that immigrants fleeing conditions which would entitle them to asylum must seek asylum in the first country they enter, in this case Mexico, instead of traveling to a second country, the USA? Margaret Tolliff.
I don't think that we have figured out a policy yet that says that if a seven-year-old shows up on the U.S. side of the border and they came from Honduras, we can just send them to Mexico and let Mexico figure it out. This has been the dual argument, which is to say, why is the U.S. trying to find a policy to deport these children back to non-contiguous countries when they could be looked at as asylees? And obviously the reason why you don't have the same problem with children fleeing from Africa is it's really hard, much harder to get here from Africa. So, this has been the conundrum. This is precisely why it's so complicated. This is the conundrum for the White House, is what are you sending these kids back to if you figure out a legal way to, release them across the border? What are you sending them back to? Where are they supposed to go? On the other hand, is it the U.S.'s responsibility to take care of 60,000 children a year?
Now, and I would just mention also, for clarification, that there's special juvenile status if a child is abused or abandoned by their family. There's asylum status if they face life-threatening persecution, and visas for victims who essentially are witnesses of serious crimes or of human trafficking. So we have a lot to sort through there as these floods continue, although they have abated to some degree. And we've come sort of to the end of this program. I want to extend thanks and gratitude to our three guests for spending this time with us and giving us their thoughts and their analysis. Again, Margaret Tolliff is White House correspondent for Bloomberg. She joined us from the nation's capital. Thank you, Margaret, for being
with
us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks also to Simon Montlake, who was with us from Boston, deputy international editor with the Christian Science Monitor. Simon, appreciate your being with us.
My pleasure.
And thank you, George Condon, White House correspondent for National Journal, who also joined us from Washington, D.C. Thank you, George.
Glad to do it.
Thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Another hour ahead, we're going to talk about child mortality. It is abated also somewhat, but remains a global crisis with all kinds of action being taken, including a program that's really quite unusual that began right in San Francisco. And remember that you can also continue this discussion online, kqed.org, or let us know what you think about what you hear or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Let me thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg, our engineer, Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.